Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Greetings from Central Florida. It's a beautiful day here. There's been some events going on. You know, some people have looked upon this new leader that has been elected as some kind of messianic figure. A couple days ago, no, I guess it was just yesterday, I saw him in front of a microphone, and behind him was a council of wise men, and on his side was a Jewish guy with the name Emmanuel. So I don't know. Something's going on. I wanted to make a brief comment, because I actually could go on for 2 hours on this one subject, and it's not really directly related to the sermon. But for 40 years, the Jewish community has been tormented. From 1968 to 2008, there's been this sort of 40-year period of trial and testing. In the 1960s, one of the potent political forces was the Black Jewish Alliance. And then after the death of Martin Luther King, it became strained, let's say. It became strained, the relationship. And this has tormented the Jewish community for 40 years. I would like to sometime, for anybody interested, give a talk on it, but because it's very interesting and fascinating. It has much more impact on our culture than you might think. But anyway, it seems like with Barack Obama's election that perhaps that has come back into action again, this Black Jewish Alliance. He has, of course, on his staff, a man named David Axelrod. At Jewish weddings, witnesses sign a document, a marriage document called the Ketubah. David Axelrod signed Rahm Emanuel's Ketubah at his wedding, and Rahm Emanuel volunteered for service in Israel, and his dad is a Jerusalem-born doctor. It gives you a little bit of an idea of what's going on. And if you analyze the major religious groups who vote, Obama got less than half of the Protestant vote, more than half of the Catholic vote, and almost 4 out of 5 of the Jewish vote. And if you look at ethnic groups, the largest ethnic group that, you know, proportion-wise to vote for Obama was, as you guessed, African Americans, but number 2 were the Jews. So as I said, it looks like maybe that alliance is back in action. That ties in maybe a little indirectly with what I want to talk about, because it does show that probably America's relationship with the State of Israel will remain intact in this administration. And that does have to do a little bit with what I want to talk about today. When major events occur in history, people's minds are often stirred to think about prophecy and how history will flow and what will happen. Now, we only have this life to live. However long we have, we don't know. But we have this life to live, the kind of life, so that when it's over, you know, we can say as Paul did, you know, we've fought the good fight, we've won the race, and our next waking moment after death will be in God's kingdom. That will be, you know, our goal. But still, we are influenced by history around us, and we have a certain interest in, well, when will the climax come? Are we going to be living in those days talked about in Scripture? Are we going to see the climax ourselves? Is it going to come soon? You know, these are the kind of ideas that people sometimes have. And there are those, frankly, who prey on this. There are those who make a living from it in a way, who exploit this interest commercially. And others exploit it from the point of view of seeking power for themselves over people. So it's sometimes, you know, used or even misused and abused. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the subject of prophecy today, because it's on people's minds when you have major historical events occur. We're right now in a major economic downturn. We've just had a peaceful, fortunately, transition of government. There are many issues in the world that are very prominent. The situation in the Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the land of Israel, among other issues, the power of Russia growing, and on it goes. China, you know, there are a lot of it's a world of that it is not a laid back environment. Let's say right now, it's not it's an environment where people have certain concerns, and when an environment like that, people tend to think about prophecy, And so I wanted to make some comments about it, just so that we'd refresh our minds in terms of what actually the conditions will be like when history comes to a climax. What is it going to be like right before Christ returns? What are going to be the major events? What will be in the news then? So I want to begin by going to Matthew 24. I'm calling this talk a peek at prophecy, because that's all it is. A peek at prophecy, 5769. You know, for this, you know, as we enter a new year in that sense, you know, from the fall of 5769, I wanted to, you know, just remind us, because if we're not reminded of these things, what will happen is we might get kind of sucked up in some movements or some weird ideas, or we might, you know, go off in one way or the other, if we don't keep the basic structure in mind, or we can't maybe help other people as much if they go off the deep end, as many people do. Many people go off in all kinds of directions in this field, and there's a lot of panic and hysteria that sets in from time to time. So we want to be able to help people and have a certain basic understanding. So I just want to go through some basic biblically demonstrated principles involving end time events, eschatology, we call it. It's a whole field of study called eschatology. I want to get into that today. So I first want to go to Matthew 24, and it does tie in briefly with the comments I made a moment ago, believe it or not. In Matthew 24 and verse 21, Christ is on the Mount of Olives, and that's a very important spot. Mount of Olives is where history comes to a climax ultimately. The Messiah comes and lands on the Mount of Olives, as we know. And when Christ left, he left from the Mount of Olives, and he's coming back to the Mount of Olives. Orthodox Jews like to be buried on the Mount of Olives. They had the idea that you kind of get a head start on the resurrection if you're buried on the Mount of Olives. So they wanted to be buried there. And on the Mount of Olives, he prophesied about end time events. And he talked about what the Jews call the labor pains before the Messiah. You know, like a woman in labor, it's very intense pain, but then the baby comes and you forget the pain. I didn't go through it personally, but I observed it four times. I was there. Anyway, Matthew 24:21, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be." So it's always darkest before the dawn, we say. And a flame has its most intense burning right before it goes out. And that's the way it's going to be. Right before Christ returns, trends will come to a head that have been rolling along all these years. And finally, the potential for evil will be more and more realized until God must intervene. And then he will change things radically. You know, he will radically alter the course of history. But in verse 22 it says, "And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." Now, I hadn't planned to read further, but maybe I should, because unfortunately these things happen. Now, people who are listening to me now are sound-minded people, I presume, because I think I know most of you listening. But it's just unfortunate how many people have just gone off the deep end and have hurt themselves and others. Just recently I saw an ad on TV for some kind of documentary which was retracing the steps of the group that left the Bay Area in California and went down to Guyana. And people drank Kool-Aid and committed suicide. You know, these kinds of things happen. Religious groups do this. And part of it is this eschatological fervor, the apocalyptic fervor that people have. Now, apocalypse, as you know, means the revelation. There is a book called The Apocalypse, The Revelation. And there's apocalyptic literature going all the way back to, of course, pre New Testament times, going back to Daniel. But these apocalyptic movements have often caused harm. And as I saw, I want to just read a little bit more. So it says, "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." You know, some people can pull some stunts. And in most cases, they're probably frauds. The time is going to come, though, when somebody will actually really have supernatural power to do things. Now, they won't be constructive things. They'll be showy things that will impress people. there'll be miracles of the sort that will get people all excited, like when statues bleed, or you know, maybe fire comes down from heaven. So what? I mean, who is benefited by that? Those kinds of things are normally done in a fraudulent way, and people are impressed. But imagine if people can really do that. You know, then people will really be impressed. But so what? Okay. I mean, so a statue bleeds. What is that supposed to be telling me? You know, but people get impressed by that sort of thing. For false Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. So even people who ought to know better can get swept up in these movements. You know, because you want to be part of, you know, when people get all excited, I mean, you saw what happened recently. When people get all excited about something, it's fun in a way to just jump on board. It's kind of hard to say, well, you know, you're all excited, but I know better. You know, hey, cool, you know, cool it, calm down. You know, it's hard sometimes to do that. It's easy sometimes just to be swept away in the, you know, in the enthusiasm of the moment, you know. And so he's saying, he's in effect warning his people not to get swept up in these movements. See, I have told you beforehand. So I'm telling you beforehand. Be careful, because things have happened already. In fact, some people I know have been swept up in things, crazy movements. I don't want to get into it specifically, but, you know, I have personal knowledge. I have friends. Therefore, if I say to you, if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. You're not, as I warned you time and time again, when things start to happen, you're not going to need me or anybody else to tell you they're happening. It's going to be very obvious that they're happening. And that's what he says. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, you know, you ought to be in Florida for an electrical storm. It's really something else. It's beautiful but scary, you know. But when you're in a safe place and watching, it is quite fascinating. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. It's going to be very obvious. But anyway, he talked about a time before his coming when all human life would disappear if God allowed things to continue on. And so it is reasonable. It is not irrational. It is not panicky to believe that we could be very close to the time of Christ's return because of what we call WMD. Human beings have not had weapons of mass destruction, anything like what we have now. We do have the capacity to literally destroy all human life from the earth now in a way that our ancestors did not have. So it's certainly reasonable to believe we could be much, much closer to the time of Christ's return just because we know the potential for extermination of the world's population. It is real. So that is a sign that we need to realize we could be close. Now, there's another sign, and I don't want to go into it at great length, but I want to briefly talk about it. And that is the return of the Jews to their ancestral homeland. The Jews were in exile for 2,000 years, and they were stateless. But if you read Bible prophecy, it assumes an organized Jewish presence in the Holy Land at the time of Christ's return. Now, that has happened, and so that's a major factor. So now you have the threat of human annihilation real, and the Jews back in their ancestral homeland, really there, with a government, with an army, you know, and those things are part of the scenario that we would expect to find before Christ returns. So it ought to, you know, it ought to put us on the alert in that sense. I want to read a verse or two on that. Since I'm in the New Testament, I'll go to Acts 1. When Christ returns, the first thing he's going to do is bail out his own people, the Israelis, because they're going to be up against it. I mean, of course, they've been up against it all along, but this time they'll really be up against it. And they'll have no option except divine deliverance, which is going to come for them. It'll be Holocaust number two unless Christ returns. Well, actually, it'd be, you know, worse than Holocaust number two. It'll be virtual end of the people number two. Or number, you know, the final end, if he wouldn't return, which he will. In Acts 1:11, I'll go back to verse 10. In fact, I'll even go back one more verse. Verse 9, Christ has said what he's going to say, and now he returns to the spirit realm, and he leaves them in that sense. Now, when he had, this is Acts 1:9. Now, when he had spoken these things, while they watched, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel. So they're not really men. very likely. They're probably angels. Who also said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven." So he's coming back down the way you saw him leave. You saw him rise, he's coming back down. You're going to see him descend, or your descendants will. And for that matter, you will if you're resurrected to be there. Then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet. So they were on the Mount of Olives. And they returned, you know, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey, 2,000 cubits or a kilometer or 5/8 of a mile, you know, is the distance. So they went back then to the city, because the Pharisees didn't want you to go out into the woods more than a kilometer on Shabbat, you know, to leave town and go beyond a kilometer. You had to make special arrangements to do that. So anyway, so the Mount of Olives is close to Jerusalem, and they were on the Mount of Olives, and the angels told them Christ is coming back just as you saw him leave, and you know, which wasn't any new information to them. You know, it's something that they should have known. So I'd like to go back now to Zechariah. When you go back towards the end of the Old Testament, first I'm going to go to Joel, which is in the beginning of the Minor Prophets. Joel 3. I'd like to go back to Joel, the third chapter. I remember giving a talk in the auditorium on this subject because I felt very strongly about certain points, and this was one of the things I was bringing out. Not that it was original with me. It was not, of course. That's one thing about being a person who talks about the Bible. You're not going to come up with anything original. It's all here. And it's, or somebody else has told you, or you've read it, you know. It's not like I get these, lightning will strike me and I get, Anyway, Joel 3. "For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring that back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem." Oh, so what's the time setting? When the Jews return to their land. "I will also gather all nations." So the Jews are going to come back to their land, and then somehow all nations are going to come there. So you see, the events in the Middle East are eventually going to draw people in to a worldwide conflict focused there. "I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat." You know, the Eternal shall has judged Jehoshaphat, which is likely the Kidron Valley there between the Mount of Olives and the upland, the Mount Moriah where the temple was, the eastern valley of Jerusalem, around Jerusalem. "I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage Israel, which they have scattered among the nations. They have also divided up my land. They have cast lots for my people, have given a boy for as payment for a harlot, and sold a girl for wine that they may drink." So the oppression and the filthy, greedy, avaricious attitude of the nations, and how they have oppressed the Jews and others. This all comes to a head, and God judges that. So at the time that the Jews come back to their land, at that time is when history comes to a climax and the nations gather in the Middle East for this final war. Now in Zechariah 12, we see that very likely if there is some worldwide organization like the UN, it will be drawn into this conflict and send forces there, which you would understand. That's happened before. There's been UN peacekeepers in the Middle East. We do have certain peacekeeping forces there now, I believe, don't we? In Zechariah 12, "The burden of the word of the Eternal against Israel, thus says the Eternal, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him." Now remember, when trouble begins to happen, it first falls on the descendants of ancient Israel, because they're the ones that are supposed to be the ones with, you know, who have the Judeo-Christian ethic, you know, that Judeo-Christian heritage. And, you know, if they stomp on it and trash it, you know, and abandon it, they're in for judgment, which is going to come. But then the other nations of the world are going to be in for their judgment. That's the way the cycle will go. "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples," Zechariah 12:2, "when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it." So, Jerusalem is going to become the sticking point, and the nations will come there, but they're not going to succeed in their in whatever their ambitions are. You know, they're going to be battling over that turf for various motives, but God is going to intervene and settle the issue. And then in verse 9, Zechariah 12:9, in that day, it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, and I will pour out, and I will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. So now the Jews are delivered, finally, and then they are reconciled with God, reconciled with the Messiah, reconciled with Jesus. It's going to be an amazing time. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn. So here we have the mass conversion of the Jews when Christ returns. And that's step one in saving humankind. You get, you know, first get the Jews on board and then turn them loose on the rest of the human race. In Zechariah 14 and I'll read a few verses of Zechariah 14. Behold, the day of the Eternal is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished. You know, very horrible events at the end there. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. So it's going to be very, very bad, but it's not going to end with a defeat. It's going to end with God's intervention. Verse 3, then the Eternal will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. That's what you heard in Acts 1. So Christ returns, Messiah returns, and lands on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north, and half of it toward the south. So we have this intervention, and it will happen because of international conflict around the area of Jerusalem. You know, these are prophecies that are here, and obviously they're much closer to fulfillment now than they would have been a century ago because of just the nature of the world as it is now. So, you know, this would be a way for our having some concept of where we are historically, but also we need to understand this is not what's happening there now. We are, you know, this is not the kind of things we're reading about now. What we're going to see then is not a local Middle Eastern problem, but an international problem with forces intervening from the outside and invading and conquering that area in order to finally resolve the conflicts. A couple of more things I'll read along those lines just so that we get a feeling for it. I'd like to go to Psalm 83. I was debating what scriptures to read, but I'll go into that one. Because Psalm 83 speaks about a momentary period, a brief period in history, which is yet to happen, when the various Arabic peoples, Muslim peoples, will all get united together, which is very rare. They're often at odds with each other and battling each other. I was in the auditorium in Pasadena and heard a representative of the Jordanian government speak of the Syrians as thugs. Now these are Arab nations that are border each other, you know, and so that's what I'm saying. In the Arab world and in the Muslim world, there's a lot of rivalries, but something's going to happen at the end, which is going to get them so riled up that they would all unite together in a very focused attempt to destroy Israel. That time is going to come, and I would suspect that the issue will be then the Temple Mount, which right now is not much of an issue. You know, the Temple Mount is always a sensitive area, but right now the Israeli government is backing away and doesn't want to involve itself in the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is now under Muslim control, and the Israeli government is leaving it that way. You know, that's the way it is now. You know, if there should ever be a dramatic change and there'd be a major Jewish presence on the Mount, it would trigger a world war. And that's what's going to eventually happen, it would seem. Psalm 83. I'll skip down to verse 5. You can see the beginning. God is we're pleading with God to intervene because his people will be destroyed if he doesn't. In verse 5, for they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. And then 10 peoples are mentioned. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebel, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia and the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria also has joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot, Selah. Think about this. All of the Middle Eastern peoples gathered together trying to destroy the Israelis. And then God is asked to intervene and conquer them so that they would repent and seek him. Verse 16, fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name, O Eternal. Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish that they may know that you, whose name alone is the Eternal, are the Most High over all the earth. So this leads to Christ's intervention and ultimately the conversion of those peoples. So it's at the end time when we will see this final thrust and final cooperation of all these various peoples against Judah. This will come very close to the end. And it will lead to foreign intervention outside of the area. It will lead, frankly, to European intervention. And I want to go to Daniel 11 and comment on that. You know, there was a time when the Roman Empire controlled the Middle East. Before that, Alexander the Great controlled the Middle East. And then, as I said, later on, the Romans. So there was a time when Europeans controlled the Middle East, and that time is coming again. There will be, once again, a foreign invasion of that area. In Daniel 11, we read about the king of the north. You know, so it's north of the land of Israel. And eventually, the empire north of Israel came to be centered in Rome. Verse 41. He shall also enter the glorious land. This is 1141. Now, by the way, what's the time setting here? Verse 40, at the time of the end. So let's go to verse 41. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. So evidently, the nation of Jordan will, for some reason, not be invaded. I don't know why they, you know, what deal they make or what power they have. Who, you know, of course, at that time there'll be Russia versus Europe, Western Europe. So will they have a deal with the Russians? Will they have a deal with the Europeans? Why will they be spared? But evidently, Jordan will be spared. Now, does that mean that that area will be a place where Christians might could be seeking refuge? It would certainly be possible. Certainly, it would seem Middle Eastern Christians might be able to seek refuge there if that area is not invaded. So that may become a place of refuge, at least for Middle Eastern Christians. Verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. So he's going to come down into Northeast Africa, Northeast Africa, and have quite a bit of power there, but his base is going to be in the Middle East. And what's going to happen is that the power that is based in Rome will ultimately move its headquarters to Jerusalem. This is ultimately what's going to happen. But news from the east and north shall trouble him. What is east and north of the land of Israel? Well, the area we call Russia. Russia will be the other power center at that time, Russia and China, threatening the Europeans. And so because of that threat, he will abandon Europe. The power based in Rome will abandon Europe and put itself in Jerusalem. But news from the east and north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. So the headquarters will move from Europe to Jerusalem between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea in the area of Jerusalem. He will move there out of concern for what's going on in Asia, in Northeast Asia. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So ultimately, he does not win. This European power that conquers the land of Israel does not win, as you know. Christ intervenes and conquers all the world. But this is the setup. These are the kind of events that will be happening. And this would have to mean a very different kind of Europe than the Europe we know today, a militaristic Europe, a hawkish Europe, unlike the Europe that we know today. And also it will mean a Europe with a revived interest in the traditional religion of Europe, which is Roman Catholicism, you know, doing battle against Islam. That's, again, not the Europe we see today. I'd like to go to Revelation, the 11th chapter. God is going to be looking out for his people at a time like that, and it talks about taking stock of who's on his side. Revelation 11. Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood saying, "Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there." Now this may have a literal meaning. It may be the Temple Mount itself will be an area where which will be off limits to any invading power. And it may be that God's servants will be able to operate from that base, because they will also be doing miracles then. Verse 2, "But leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they shall tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. Now, you know what that is, it's 3 years, 3.5 years. So we see that before Christ returns, there's going to be a foreign occupation of the city of Jerusalem for 3.5 years. And during that time, God will have prophets who will be witnessing, and they will be miraculously protected. So these are amazing events that will really change people's mindset about a lot of issues. You know, you're not going to have a lot of people then that are going to be questioning whether there is a spirit realm, whether there is a God, whether there is a devil. You know, those matters are going to be settled in those days. Verse 3, "And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth, 3.5 years. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. And if anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies." So they will have miraculous protection. "And if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this manner." So we see a foreign occupation of Jerusalem and yet a protection for those doing God's work at that time. Now, Christ spoke of this time in the book of Luke. Well, let's put it this way. He spoke of it, and then Luke recorded it as Matthew did. I started in Matthew. I want to go to Luke now. Luke 21. Luke 21. Verse 24. Luke 21:24. So these are sad things to read, but the good news is that it will finally end with the millennium beginning. It's just sad that it has to come to that first. Luke 21:24, "And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." Well, if you go to Jerusalem now, the Israeli government controls East Jerusalem, and there are Jews living there under the protection of the Israeli government. Now, the Temple Mount itself is under Muslim control, but basically East Jerusalem is part of Israel. In fact, it was annexed by the Israeli government. I know few countries have recognized it, but they didn't like it. But in 1967, as you know, the Israelis annexed the eastern part of Jerusalem to western part of Jerusalem, united the city. And now they want it, that united city, to be their capital. So they talk about Jerusalem, D.C., Jerusalem, David's capital. You know, that's what they want to see. Now, obviously, the other side wants to split East Jerusalem off and make it the capital of the new Palestinian state. That's one of the complications that delays any kind of Middle East peace, is the status of Eastern Jerusalem. Well, here we see that Gentiles will once again occupy Eastern Jerusalem for until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, how long is that period of time? Well, I read it to you elsewhere in the Bible, 3.5 years. So this is what's coming somewhere in the future, a foreign invasion which occupies Jerusalem, the eastern part of Jerusalem, for a 3.5 year period. And at that time, two witnesses prophesying in a miraculous manner. These are events that will happen in the future that the Bible prepares us to know about in advance. All right, with that in mind then, let's go to Revelation 13. Now, of course, it is this Satan's desire to destroy the church. Right now, the church doesn't amount to much. Evidently, there's going to be quite a revival of the church, and it will become so much of a threat that the persecution will come in a very intense way. You know, right now, the church isn't much of a threat to anybody, but the time is going to come when there's going to be a great revival of the church, and at that time, the church will then be facing persecution. And to direct the persecution will be this world power that will rise up, which will be a revival of the Roman Empire. Now, in ancient times, these things were talked about in Daniel, in the book of Daniel. Daniel was a book you could call apocalyptic in the Old Testament. And the second chapter of Daniel showed how history would progress and four empires would rule in the land of Israel. Now, that's what has happened historically. The prophecy has been fulfilled, you know, whether people like it or not. You know, whatever skeptics don't, you know, want to say about it, it happened. You know, you had the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greco-Macedonian Empire, and the Roman Empire. They have come and ruled those areas. And the Bible then speaks of seven resurrections of that Roman Empire, and the seventh one that is there when Christ returns, ruling over the Middle East. Daniel 7 has a prophecy again about those four empires, picturing them as various beasts, and then a fourth beast, which is a kind of composite beast, not an animal such as we would see now. But, you know, the first is a lion, and then you have a leopard, and then you have a bear. I'm sorry, a bear and then a leopard. A lion, a bear, and a leopard. And then you finally have a beast that, you know, is like a composite. So anyway, in Daniel... in Revelation 13, you know, let's take Daniel 7, which I hope you have some familiarity with. You know, just realize that there are four beasts there: the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the composite beast. We used to draw it looking like a triceratops. So let's, you know, whatever you want to call it, the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the triceratops. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know. Anyway, then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on the horns ten crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. So this is a terrifying thing to see. Now, why is there either seven heads? Because the Roman Empire had seven revivals, and ten horns should be probably on the seventh head, because these ten horns are ten kings that oppose Christ in the end. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Oh, you know, so you know, if you've read Daniel, you have the background for this. The dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So Satan is inspiring this power, and one of the major motives of Satan in bringing up this power is to stamp out the church, which right now you don't need a lot of effort to do that, but at that point evidently you will. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. You know, the Roman Empire fell. You ever hear about that? The Roman Empire fell, but then there were revivals, as I said. Justinian revived it from the east. He ruled in the city of Constantinople, later called Byzantium, later taken over by the Muslim Turks. Now it's called Istanbul. When I was a child, I used to collect stamps. And I have beautiful Turkish stamps from 1953. That was the 500th anniversary of when the Turks took over Byzantium and renamed it Istanbul. But anyway, so that was a resurrection of that empire under Justinian. But then it was restored again in 800 under Charlemagne, Charles the Great of France. And then we have the First Reich, the first German, you know, the first realm centered in the German-speaking world, of Otto the Great in 962. Then we have Charles the Great, Charles the Fifth, another, not the Charles of Charlemagne, but Charles the Fifth of the Habsburg dynasty, which was an Austrian based dynasty, and he ruled over a vast empire in the 1500s. Then we had Napoleon. You know, he the Pope recognized him as an emperor, and as I recall the story, the Pope was going to crown him, but he just took the crown and put it on his own head in front of the Pope. But so indirectly the Pope crowned him. Probably the Pope wanted to crown him right then. But anyway, he took the crown, put it on his own head, And so he became an Emperor Napoleon, and that was a fifth resurrection of that Roman Empire. A sixth one occurred under Mussolini. He thought he was reviving the Roman Empire, and he had a deal with the Vatican. He made a pact with the Pope, which became the Lateran Treaty in 1929, and he had an agreement with the Pope, and then he revived the Roman Empire. But he was later on excelled by Hitler. Hitler became the dominant force. There was an axis. Remember, it was called Axis. Switzerland was neutral, but we had Germany and Austria as a nation. Italy united with them. It was called the Axis. And Hitler became the dominant force there. So now you had the Third Reich. There was also a Second Reich. I'll comment on in a moment. But now you had a Third Reich, which did have a relationship through Mussolini with the Catholic Church. Now that is the common denominator of these revivals. There was always a combination of church and state. There was a cooperation between the secular rulers and the Catholic Church. It wasn't always affectionate. I mean, both were power centers and battling for to be dominant. The secular authority and the priestly authority, ecclesiastical authority, battled for dominance. But they interacted to dominate the world of their day, and that's the way it has been. Now there was one revival which was non-Catholic. It was a Protestant revival, the Second Reich under Kaiser Wilhelm. That's why we had the First World War, because Germany challenged Great Britain and France for world domination and lost. But Kaiser Wilhelm had a Protestant empire, so that was an eighth one. So you had the seven and then an eighth one. I mention that because it's in the Bible. Not the way I'm interpreting it. Obviously you could disagree with my spin, but there's an eighth one mentioned in the Bible. I'm going to read about in a moment. So let's go on here. Verse 3. And I saw one of the heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. So indirectly they're worshipping Satan by worshipping this power, this dictator. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. So his great power intensifies for a 3.5-year period. So once again, you see that 3.5-year period before Christ returns. So the Great Tribulation is roughly a 3.5-year period before Christ returns, when things really go as bad as they're ever going to get. Now there's a secondary fulfillment of this prophecy, and that is that this Roman Empire waxed and waned from between 554 and 1814, which is 1260 years. And then in 1814, with the end of Napoleon, there was a century where the Anglo-Saxon world became very powerful and made a major impact on the world. And kept a peaceful period for when there was a civil war in America, but there were no major world conflicts for about a century, and the power of the Anglo-Saxon world, and so this pretty much broke the domination of Catholicism, and even World War I was, as I said, Kaiser Wilhelm was not dominated by the Catholic Church, so it wasn't until Mussolini that we had a revival of that other matter. So anyway, so for 42 months, or 1260 years, 554 to 1814, we had the waxing and waning of these empires influenced by Catholicism. Then you had a period of secularization in Europe, anti-clerical feeling, the rise of Protestantism and so on. And so it went into a kind of decline, but it was revived again in the Axis years, and will be again, yet again. I'm going to continue reading now. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. So he does persecute Christians and martyr Christians, as has happened before. Christianity does have a history of martyrdom, and it goes back, to before the Old Testament, to the days of the Maccabees. There were martyrdoms at the time of the Maccabees. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. as we know, Jesus Christ, that commitment had to be made from the beginning when Adam and Eve sinned, and even before, the commitment had to be there that Christ would come and die for us. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with a sword must be killed with a sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. What goes around comes around. You know, those who persecute will themselves be punished. You know, there is justice ultimately. There is justice ultimately. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. So this is a false prophet who seems to be a Christ-like figure, but he actually is encouraging people to worship the tyrant. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So he is a false prophet encouraging people to follow this dictator. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. He doesn't do anybody any good, but he performs a lot of sensational signs. So if you're just looking for signs, at that time you'll see them. But that's not what you should be looking for. Just be looking for the example of the person. You know, is he a commandment keeper or not? Now, I'd like to go back to Deuteronomy, the 13th chapter, if I may. Deuteronomy 13. Now, here is the warning. When Israel was a theocracy, it would not have allowed false prophets, no matter how many miracles they did, that they would have been gotten rid of. If there arises among you, Deuteronomy 13, a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass, of which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. I don't care if he does a wonder. If he tells you to do that, then he's a fake. You shall not listen to the words of the prophet or of that dreamer of dreams, for the Eternal is your God is testing you to know whether you love the Eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall walk after the Eternal your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice. You shall serve him and hold fast to him. So you're not going to compromise your standards and follow some prophet, false prophet, even if he does wonders. You're not going to compromise your standards. You're going to preserve God's way of life. And that person is going to have to be done away with if he wants to try to corrupt the country and do wonders and try to seduce people away from the right way of life, because they'll be made miserable. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has spoken in order to turn you away from the Eternal your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage, to entice you from the way in which the Eternal your God commanded you to walk, so you shall put away the evil from your midst. So that's the warning. But, you know, at that time in history, there's going to be just a lot of enthusiasm. You know, people go with the flow. And there's going to be tremendous enthusiasm for the dictator, the prophet who does wonders and encourages people to follow that dictator. And they're not going to be very happy with dissenters then. You know, if you know you don't want to rain on their parade, they'll be very upset with you. And to go on now to verse 14, is that where I am? And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast and who was wounded by the sword and lived. So what we're talking about here in the metaphoric sense is that the Roman Empire will be revived, its institutions, the way it was organized. That's probably the image of the beast, although they may also do an idol of him as well, literally a statue of him or an idol of him. But also it's talking about the system, the way it was, the image of the beast, meaning the structure, the form of that empire. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, in other words, to empower that system, that form, that organization, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So, as I said, it may involve miraculous idol as well. That's possible. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. When you dedicate your work, I mean, my father-in-law used to say, you either use your brain or your brawn. You either do mental work or physical work. Now, obviously, any mental work is going to normally involve some physical effort as well. And any physical work involves, obviously, mental effort as well. But there are certain jobs that are more intellectual and certain jobs that are more physical. you know, brain or brawn. But he's going to expect people to serve him with their brain or their brawn, whether, you know, intellectually or physically. They're going to have to devote themselves to serving the system. They're going to have to get into the system and serve him. So they're going to have a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, meaning they're going to, you know, follow him, you know, in terms of their actions and their thoughts. You know, the brains will have to serve him, the brawny ones will have to serve him. And that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So you're going to have to be in that system and, you know, properly certified. You know, nowadays we have certain IDs. Sometimes we can't, you know, do business without certain identification. At that time, there'll be a standard way of identifying people who are part of the system. And if you're not, you know, you've had it. No work for you, right? No employment for you, which means ultimately no food. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. Its number is 666. Now, in the text that we have, it's written in words, 666. It's not just three digits, 666. But there in the Vaticanus, in the text that was found, a very, very old Greek text that is now, I believe, in the Vatican, the so-called Vaticanus text, I think it is simply just three Greek letters that equals 666. The letter he, the letter xi, the letter stigma, it equals 666. But in most Bibles, it's actually written out as a word. So anyway, when this dictator comes to power, his name, and very possibly the name of his realm, whatever it's called, like we call our country the United States of America. So someday there'll be some power, you know, that will rise up with 10 kings, as I've told you, and it will have a dictator running it. And the name of that system, or his personal name, if you take the numerical value of it, will equal 666. Now here's where I'm speculating. I don't think a dictator is going to rise up in the future and deliberately allow his name or the name of his empire to come out in Greek letters to be 666, because I just don't think he'd want to do it. That's a PR mistake, right? You don't do that. So what I suspect will happen is that he will avoid that, but by an oversight, if you go below, one level below, because John didn't just write using the Greek number system, he also used the Hebrew numerical system. So sometimes you have to go below the surface to the Hebrew numerical system. And I suspect, this is my speculation, that if you go and if you spell this person's title in Hebrew, or the title of this empire in Hebrew, it will equal 666 when that time comes, which it has not yet come. But that's what I'm suspecting, because otherwise it would seem to be rather obvious. If it says right here it's going to equal 666, if I were, you know, running things, I would make sure that it didn't, you know. But I suspect that maybe you have to go below the Greek and back to the Hebrew. But obviously, English doesn't matter. This book wasn't written in English. John didn't know English. You know, John knew the Hebrew alphabet and the Greek alphabet. He didn't know English, so we're not going to look for, you know, whatever name, Daniel Solomon Kaplan or whatever name you're going to come up with and try to come. It had to come out to 666, you know. And that's anyway in the future. All right, now the timekeeper is getting on my back, so I'm going to go to Revelation 17, and here Revelation 17 expands upon Daniel 2. Okay, now by the way, the Oregonian who listens, I hope you signed up for more than an hour at the library where you listen. This man studies in the same library that Mr. Armstrong studied in the 1920s. In fact, there's a plaque there. No, but anyway, Revelation 17. I'm going to have to jump forward here. We have this fallen woman, this whore, you know, this harlot, you know. But she pictures a false religious system, and it doesn't mean that you don't like persons who are members of that system. You know, each person you judge based upon that person. You know, as Martin Luther King said, you know, you don't go by the color of his skin or by the content of his character, nor do you go by his affiliation, right? You judge a person by that person. But this system has been oppressive and will again be oppressive, unfortunately. It's sorry to say that, you know, but it is a religion that has oppressed people in the past and will yet oppress them in the future. And it's pictured as a fallen woman here. And it has a relationship with the powers in Europe that sometimes they cooperate and sometimes they're rivals. It's called in Revelation 17:5, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. That's how she's described, and it's written in the all caps in Greek. So we have it here written in English in all caps, as a, you know. So let's go and talk about the. Let's just jump ahead, verse 9. Well, one thing I should say. Let me look at this another beast. This is in verse 3. She's riding this beast. This woman rides this beast. As I said, these political empires are influenced by this church, and they have a relationship with it. Verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Okay, by the way, the ten horns in Revelation 13 may refer not to those final ten kings, but to ten empires that existed. Besides the seven resurrections of the Roman Empire, there were three different barbarian kingdoms that ruled over Rome that were later displaced. So that may be why you get ten horns in Revelation 13. The seven resurrections of the Roman Empire plus the three barbarian kingdoms that ruled Rome. But in this case, we're talking here about those final ten kings that fight against Christ, as you'll see. There are ten horns, and it tells you what they are as you keep reading. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not. So it existed and then died, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. So it comes up again, but eventually it's destroyed. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is, when they see this revived empire that had died and came back, right? Is everybody still with me? No confusion, I hope. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Okay, seven kingdoms which were influenced by this church. And of course, there's a city built on seven hills, the famous, you know, seven hills of Rome. There are also seven kings. These seven heads are these seven kings. Five are fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Now that's interesting. John is seeing a vision. This is a vision, remember. And in this vision, it says that five kings have fallen and one is. So he's being taken to the time of the sixth empire. John has been transported into the 1930s and 40s in this vision when Mussolini was ruling and perhaps Hitler. Now, why would that be so important that John is taken there? Well, perhaps because the end time events in a way have their, in a way, a very significant beginning there. After all, it's in that time period when you have the Holocaust. It's in that time period when you have the development of atomic weaponry. It's in that time when you have the Church of God beginning to use the modern media in a way it had never done before. The print media and then the electronic media, beginning with radio and later TV. So that is such a significant period, and it also kind of foreshadows the final period. What happened in World War II, as terrible as it was a foreshadowing of what will yet happen. There are also seven kings. By the way, I want everybody to know that I know that that's not rain. It's air conditioning, this noise that we hear. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. Fortunately, that last dictator that I read to you about is not going to rule for long. And as I said, the intense time is only a 3.5-year time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. And he is of the seven and is going to perdition. Why are there eight? I mentioned. There was the non-Catholic empire of Kaiser Wilhelm. The ten horns which you saw. You see, I don't have to interpret it. The Bible says what the ten horns are. So instead of just speculating and chewing the rag, you know, just read on. You know, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings. Okay, that's what it says. Which have received no kingdom as yet. So they weren't ruling in John's day. They're going to be ruling in the future before Christ returns. But they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. A very short time. They are given short authority for a short time. So ten dictators, evidently, will rise up, and these ten dictators will be under the authority of one major dictator, and also will be influenced by the religious system that has influenced Europe over the centuries. Well, you know, you don't see that now, obviously. You look at, you wake up tomorrow morning and you have your scrambled eggs or whatever you have, and you look at your newspaper. That's not what the world that we know right now. It isn't. Anyway, these are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast, but for a short time. And believe it or not, and of course you do believe it because you know the Bible, they're going to actually oppose Jesus Christ when he returns. Maybe they will think he's an extraterrestrial invader. We have more and more people who believe now in UFOs and extraterrestrials and this sort of thing. In fact, I've personally visited Area 51. No, I'm kidding. You know, but we have all of the, a lot of people believe in these sorts of things now. So when he comes, they're going to think it's an outer space invasion, and they will fight him. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. You know, I hope that's us. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw, and see, this. Let's go back to verse 17, chapter 17, verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Because when people gather together, they make a thunderous noise like waters, the waves of water, or like a waterfall or whatever, and the turbulence of waters. You know, the waters in the Bible are often a symbol of turbulence. So these masses of people are like waters. And so he said, so it comes up out of the waters, meaning it comes up out of these many peoples. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw, on the beast, these will hate the harlot. And this happens in history. You can read about it. Right now, in fact, Europe is very secular and very anti-religious. And that's because they were so oppressed in the past. And so you have in Europe anti-clericalism, which in the United States there isn't such a thing very much. You don't have this hatred of organized religion that you have in Europe. And even those who don't like organized religion in America, what they have is unorganized religion. They have their own independent religions. But the people in Europe who hate organized religion are non-religious people. They are secular. You know, they don't go to their own independent Bible study groups. They go, you know, I don't want to tell you where they go. You can guess. All right? And the ten horns, which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, and eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. So eventually, they attack the church, as often happens in Europe. There's a cooperation, then finally the politicians say enough, you know, and they go after the church. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast, until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So this is going to be a final Roman Empire based in Rome, and then ultimately, you know, it will shift to Jerusalem. But spiritually speaking, it's a continuation of Babylon, the empire that was based in ancient times in Iraq, in Babylon. And it goes all the way back really to the Tower of Babel in a way. But then it goes back to Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. And so we see here that in Revelation 18... that Babylon is spiritually speaking how this empire is described, and it will fall. It will fall. God is going to defeat it. And in verse 4, he warns us to keep out of it. You know, we have our responsibility to maintain our standards and not to get involved in that system. Verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues, for his sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. So there's going to be pressure then to conform, but don't. It'll save you a lot of trouble momentarily, but it leads to destruction ultimately. So if you have to, you know, if we have to be martyred, then so be it. You know, but we don't want to cooperate with that system any more than we would have liked, you know, to cooperate with Nazism and fascism in those days. So God says, come out of her, my people. That is his message. Now, if you keep reading, you find that Babylon falls. And how does it fall? Because ultimately Christ returns. We're in Revelation 19. After these things, I heard a voice of a great multitude in heaven saying, Alleluia! Why did they say Alleluia? Because the Greeks don't have an H. We Hebrews say Hallelujah, but the Greeks have to say Alleluia because they don't have an H anymore. After these things, I heard a loud voice of a great multitude in heaven saying, Alleluia! Salvation and glory and honor and power belong to the Lord our God. For true and righteous are his judgments, because he has judged the great harlot who corrupted the earth with her fornication, and he has avenged on her the blood of his servants shed by her. Let's jump to verse 16. Christ returns, and how is he described? And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So that's finally how it ends. You know, Christ returns, the saints are resurrected, and we enter a millennial time. Now, I wanted to review these things. They're very basic. And I speculated some, but most of what I did was right in the Bible. And a lot of what I didn't prove to you, I could have proven, given the time, from Scripture. You know, I didn't deviate much from just from the written word, frankly, and from history that you can study on your own. So I hope that I've given you a kind of a basic understanding of where ultimately, you know, history is going, when that climax occurs, and the kind of things to, you know, that you'll be, you know, experiencing we are if we're alive at that time. I want to finish now by going to the book of Ephesians. Now, in the meantime, be aware of what the Bible says so that you're not deceived with some other idea. You know, realize what the Bible says about the end time and what's going to happen so that you're not misled and you don't go off on some tangent. And then realize that whatever's ahead, we have our own lifetime, and that's all we have, our own lifetime. We want to do as best we can, and we also want to influence people in the future. You know, it'd be wonderful if our lives influenced others even after we're not here to continue on. In Ephesians, the 5th chapter, I want to go to verse 15 of Ephesians. Ephesians 5:15. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. You know, there's an awful lot of problems in the world. That's just the nature of the world. And so for that reason, we need to make use of the time we have in a positive way and act wisely. You know, this is our responsibility, to be wise, not foolish. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Let's seek God's will and do it. Well, if you've managed to survive through this talk, it has now come to a conclusion. So thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of the Sabbath and the week ahead. All the best to you and yours.